From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Regular listeners know that this program is not made for media practitioners, but for people who daily confront and consume media in all its forms. Not just journalism, but advertising, video games, and of course, vanity license plates. That said, this hour is about journalism, and also reality. The first is a desperate suitor, the latter an increasingly elusive and capricious object of desire. Journalism, spurned and frustrated, clearly is going about this all wrong.
I mean, if journalists are to fulfill their mission to inform and equip citizens to participate in our democracy, they'll have to overturn decades of tradition. They'll have to resist the reflex to view the president's every utterance as news. They'll have to report on the context before the tweet and to choose which facts to check. They'll have to use more independent judgment than they have in perhaps 100 years, or leave the public to be seduced and abandoned.
In our research, it was mostly left-leaning political analysts who were publicly pondering this challenge to the press, so it's their thoughts you'll hear. This week's news, of course, was dominated by Donald Trump's final press conference as president-elect, and it was bizarre. His staffers came to literally cheer, and the stage was set with a table stacked with prop files filled with pages Trump said he'd personally signed to ensure no conflicts of interest.
You could call it unprecedented, except that it's happened before. In Russia, as Alexei Kovalev noted in Medium, this is pretty much how Vladimir Putin choreographs his rare press conferences. He dominates, and everything, everyone else is a prop. Kovalev also noted that there is no camaraderie among the Russian press. They are fierce competitors, even as they duck and cover under Putin's endless volleys of lies. Which brings us back to this week's press conference. CNN's Jim Acosta was trying to ask a question shortly after Trump went off on CNN incorrectly for its handling of the Russia dossier story.
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody... No, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
Belittled, then cut off. Whereupon the rest of the press corps, in defense of their colleague and of the very First Amendment, heroically stepped forward as one.
I'm Spartacus!
To demand an answer to Acosta's question, because denying press freedom to one denies press freedom to all. Oh, wait. No, they didn't. They just stepped over Acosta's body to get their own questions in. Oh, Mr. President-elect, pick me! Naturally, no satisfactory answer was forthcoming, and there never will be. So, why be played? For the Trump press corps to be any more useful than the Putin press corps, it must place mission above competition and vanity and pointless posturing. Don't be slaves to a rigged system. Be Spartacus, just for a moment, just once. Be Spartacus.
Obviously, what set Trump's blood boiling and fingers tweeting was a dossier that had been floating around Capitol Hill. For months, there had been rumors of an investigation by someone into Trump's ties to and behavior in Russia. It finally emerged in full on BuzzFeed, all 35 salacious, unverified pages, the work of a British intelligence sleuth.
I think it's a disgrace that information that was false and fake and never happened, got released to the public. As far as BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, writing it, I think they're going to suffer the consequences. They already are.
This Week in Slate, which also hosted the full dossier, writer Will Oremus examined the sticky ethics of BuzzFeed's decision, and he noted that BuzzFeed did serve up the dossier with more than a pinch of salt.
BuzzFeed presented it as, we know that this might not be true, so regard it with skepticism, but here's the full unedited document, and we leave it to Americans to make up their own minds. I find that a little disingenuous in a way, because if the entire U.S. intelligence apparatus can't make up their minds as to whether this is true, how is the average American supposed to make up their mind? You know, that part I think was maybe a little hard to stomach.
It's almost unbelievably BS-y. In a court of law, a jury, their whole job is to make up their minds. But if information is unverified or false, they're told to disregard it. And here you've basically tainted the public opinion jury pool, as it were.
Yeah, I think you've just made the con side of the case for publishing this pretty strongly. To add a word on the pro side, you know, this is a document that is being evaluated and discussed at the highest levels of U.S. government, and it's a document that people are alluding to in public hearings. And so the question that organizations like BuzzFeed and many others were no doubt wrestling with is, we have this information. Shouldn't we err on the side of disclosing something that's clearly newsworthy? If not because it's true, then at least because it is shaping what's happening in Washington right now.
I loved how you wrote about the trajectory of this story. BuzzFeed presumably published it in part because CNN was reporting on it. CNN was reporting on it because intelligence officials had briefed Trump on it. Intelligence officials briefed Trump on it because senior congressional leaders were passing it around. Senior congressional leaders may have been passing it around in part because Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid alluded to it in a letter blasting FBI Director James Comey for publicizing information harmful to Hillary Clinton but not publicizing the dirt on Trump. Each act, you wrote, lowered the bar for those who followed to act on information they knew might or might not be true.
Yeah, and one of the parallels that came to mind immediately when this happened was Matt Drudge, one of the original political bloggers, published the allegations about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, but the story was not about the allegations per se. The story was framed as Newsweek is sitting on an explosive story about Bill Clinton and an intern. So Drudge justified it by making it a media story.
At that time, I was National Public Radio's media correspondent. NPR wasn't going to report on the stained dress of Monica Lewinsky, but they did ask me to report on the coverage of the stained dress, a by now well-known kind of dodge for taking responsibility for actually covering the story, and I wouldn't do it.
Now that I think about it, isn't it one of the rhetorical maneuvers that is favored by our president-elect, Donald Trump? He always uses that phrase, people are saying.
Okay, so in the memo, Smith also said that the decision to publish the full text, quote, reflects how we see the job of reporters in 2017, and that brings us back to Matt Drudge, because one could argue that that was the beginning of the digital age of news transmission.
Yeah, and it's tempting to think we now live in this era where nothing can be secret, where there's no privacy, where media can serve no gatekeeping role, as the journalism ethics phrase has it, because everything is going to get published and information wants to be free, and if we don't publish it, somebody else will. I think it's fascinating, given all of that, that this took so long to come out. I mean, it took weeks or months of a lot of people knowing this information for it to finally come out to the public. So I think it says that the role of media as gatekeeper, it's not totally dead.
So what are the stakes, pro and con, for release or not releasing?
There are big stakes here. And one of the potential upsides is, you know, sometimes you have this information, it's floating around, people are investigating it, and they're getting nowhere. But once it becomes public, all of a sudden, you know, anybody in the world can step in and say, well, I know this guy wasn't in Prague when the report said he was in Prague, and people can step forward with information. So that could be a good outcome. On the downside, I mean, if this all turns out to be demonstrably untrue, it looks really bad for BuzzFeed, and it just reinforces the conservative narrative that the mainstream media is in no place to throw stones because you can't trust them at all either.
Even assuming that these allegations against Trump that are in the dossier ultimately will be verified, let's just say that as a point of argument, it's still distracting us now during these news cycles about what it is that he plans to do when he gets into office, about Obamacare, about paying for the wall across the southern border, not to mention the point of that press conference, which was all about his conflicts of interest. Isn't this just serving as a monumental distraction at precisely the wrong time?
Isn't everything? I mean, it is fascinating. I saw someone describe it as though the Trump campaign was a denial of service attack on the entire media. And a denial of service attack being that thing where you enlist, you know, so many computer bots to request information from the same server at once that the whole system crashes. I mean, Trump kind of does that to the media. If you have enough outrageous stuff going on at once, there's no way that the media can possibly keep up with all of it. And all of it ends up getting covered less than it would otherwise.
Slate also released the 35-page dossier.
And it happened while I was writing about BuzzFeed's decision to release the 35-page dossier. So I emailed our editor-in-chief, Julia Turner, requesting comment. Why did you publish this dossier? What she said is, they're newsworthy documents, and then BuzzFeed's decision to publish was news, too. That's how the bar gets progressively lowered. The fact that people are talking about it becomes news in itself. And then the fact that it's news, you know, justifies other people talking about it and so on.
So you disagree with Julia there?
By journalism ethics, BuzzFeed made the wrong decision. I might argue that Slate made the wrong decision, too. But there are some cases in which putting information out there can have positive consequences for the world that transcend narrow questions of journalism ethics. I think journalists have a bias toward publication because people in power have a bias against embarrassing stuff being published. And that is part of the role of journalists in the society, is to serve as a counterweight to the forces of secrecy and behind-the-scenes manipulation and cover-ups. So, you know, it's a really tough question, and this is incredibly weaselly, but I am not going to say that I know for sure that it was the right or the wrong call.
I think we can all agree, however, that they were really fun to read.
Ben Smith will never tell you that that could have played any possible role in publishing this.
Will, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Will Oremus is a senior writer for Slate.
Coming up, a taxonomy of Trump's tweets.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, with a taxonomy of Trump tweets. Cognitive linguist George Lakoff believes that the press must understand how Trump uses language if we're going to responsibly report on those tweets and not just magnify their misinformation. He's come up with a few categories for thinking about Trump tweets, and the first is preemptive framing.
The idea of preemptive framing is to frame an issue before other people get a chance to put the idea out there first. For example, quote, "The only reason the hacking of the poorly defended DNC is discussed is that the loss by the Dems was so big they were totally embarrassed."
Right.
And the idea is that the hacking of the DNC was the default of the DNC.
Also, the idea that the Dems lost so big when, in fact, it was one of the narrowest losses in history. So that's all framed, so you have to go back and deconstruct the tweet before you can even address it.
Exactly. You have to understand what the framing is, and what the framing is he's trying to avoid. You know, he said, "In addition to winning the Electoral College in a landslide, I won the popular vote, if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally." Right? No reason to think anybody voted illegally, but what he's doing is trying to reframe the popular vote.
So let's move on to another category you talk about, the diversion tweet.
The diversion tweet occurs when there's some major issue that's come up. And what he'll do is do things like attack Meryl Streep. You know, Meryl Streep, one of the most overrated actresses in Hollywood. She is a Hillary flunky who lost big. The idea is to get people on TV talking about Meryl Streep, not talking about the real issues. In this case, conflict of interest and the Russian hacking.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, he had done the attack on Hamilton. You know, the cast and producers of Hamilton, which I hear is highly overrated, should immediately apologize to Mike Pence for their terrible behavior.
I think at that time, the big issue was his $25 million settlement over the Trump University case.
So that all the people on New York radio and TV and so on are going to talk about Hamilton instead of talking about Trump University.
Let's move quickly on to your third category, the trial balloon.
Right. Trial balloon. He says, the United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capacity until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes. He's going to see how people react to this, and then he'll know what to do in the future. People were confused. They talked about, you know, nuclear proliferation a little bit, and then it went away. And then the fourth category is deflection,
mm-hmm.
where you attack the messenger. So they attacked BuzzFeed, CNN, the BBC, for putting out the discussion of the Russian leaks.
Putting out the entire dossier is arguably premature.
It is premature on the one hand. On the other hand, he's going to be in office in a week.
So there was one from Wednesday this week that you say embodies all four of these categories: preemptive framing, diversion, trial balloon, and deflection. I will read it. It is, intelligence agencies should not have allowed this fake news to leak into the public. One last shot at me. Are we living in Nazi Germany?
First, preemptive framing. This is fake news. Secondly, diversion. It's going to be discussed whether or not it's fake news or should have been leaked rather than the content.
Right.
There's deflection, which is attacking the messengers. And then you get the trial balloon. Will the intelligence agencies be stopped from doing this? Are they working like Nazi Germany?
Obviously, you don't think the media are handling these utterances very well. What do you suggest that we do?
The media is addicted to breaking news. So we have to give the tweet first. That's the breaking news. Wrong. Because that allows him to manipulate you as a reporter and manipulate the truth.
So you're saying don't report on the tweet?
You begin by telling the truth and giving the evidence for that truth. Then mention his tweet, point out that that contradicts the truth, and then talk about what kind of tweet this is. You know, you say, this is a case of diversion. Here's what he is diverting. Quickly. Don't have a panel discussion about it. You know, just do it and go on. Keep going back to substance and the truth. Also, what is the effect of his tweeting on the truth? He's trying to say, usually, that this truth is a general truth. And that's another thing that I should add to this list of the things he does, is to take a specific case and say that it's the general case.
Give me an example.
There's a rape or a murder, a shooting by a Mexican. He says, they're rapists and killers. He does that all the time.
What do you call that?
Salient exemplar.
So this sort of extrapolation from one example is the salient exemplar. I like that.
And let me give you one more little thing.
Sure.
There's a difference between direct and systemic causation. So the lawyer at his press conference, who is dealing with conflicts of interest, took up the question of emoluments. Suppose another government books rooms at Trump's hotel. Is this a conflict of interest? What she said was, quote, this is not what the Constitution says. Paying for a hotel room is not a gift or a present, and it has nothing to do with an office. It is not an emolument. Now, in general, paying one night for a hotel room might not be. Somebody who's dealing with the government, paying for a month of hotel rooms in a hotel that enriches Trump, is an emolument. It's indirect causation like that.
Mm-hmm.
You look at not just the particular of the frame, but the way in which that frame functions as part of a system.
So she says one night in a hotel room is the frame, and thereby removes from the table any kind of enrichment you can get from people spending any amount of money in your hotel.
Exactly. And what allows this to happen is every language of the world in its grammar allows direct causation. No language of the world in its grammar has systemic causation. There's a very good reason. Languages are learned by children. And little children learning languages don't know about systemic causation. For example, if I say I took a drink, you know, the assumption is I took a drink at a particular time at a particular place. That is direct causation.
And then you say, I take a drink. There's a tone there that suggests you didn't just take one, but you take one regularly.
Right. That is systemic.
So she used a particular simple grammar and thereby created a precedent for us to discount all hotel usages from there on out.
Exactly.
George, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Brooke.
George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist and author of several books, including Metaphors We Live By and Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate.
So we've heard advice from George Lakoff on how to handle tweets, but how should we view the rest of Trump's stunts and diversions, and how should we report on them? Well, obviously, first we must consider what drives them, not just individually, but as Lakoff advises, systemically.
It's a very simple formula in entertainment and television. If you get good ratings, and these aren't good, these are monster, then you're going to be on all the time, even if you have nothing to say.
Nathan Robinson, editor-in-chief of the progressive publication Current Affairs.
Because he has suggested that this has been part of his sales strategy, building this persona, I do think there's reason to believe that a certain amount of it is put on deliberately, that he plays up the outrageousness.
Let's just talk about his claim earlier this week that the inauguration is going to be so great, great, great. You can't even buy a dress in Washington, D.C. They're all sold out. Now, whether or not there is a sufficient supply of ball gowns is obviously of no significance to anybody. But the fact that the president-elect simply invents stuff, isn't that in and of itself newsworthy?
Well, it would be in a different era, but now we're in the Trump era, and we have to distinguish between the time that we spend trying to make people understand the lies that are most significant.
What you're describing is triage, devoting the limited resources to the cardiac cases first and letting the people suffering with this broken ankle sit in pain in the waiting room. How do you make that call in the heat of the moment?
First, I think it has to be a commitment to understanding what the issues that matter are, understanding that if climate change is something that is threatening human civilization, it has to dominate what we talk about every day, and then a commitment on journalists to make sure that in their work they are prioritizing what their mission is. The thing we need to understand is we think if he is embarrassing himself, he must care, but he really doesn't care. The people who did the Comedy Central roast of him a couple of years back, the comedians who were writing the material said it was weird that he didn't actually mind being embarrassed and humiliated as long as people were watching him and nothing else.
He will not directly answer any question. It almost sounds as if you're suggesting that we don't bother with a Trump press conference at all.
I don't think you can totally ignore the president's press conferences. I think this is really a matter of allocating your time and resources carefully, because he's still going to be the president tomorrow, he's still going to be the president the day after that, and he's going to be exactly the same every single day.
Now, I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, and that is the fact that we're just in a different reality. And that hate speech, racism, sexual assault, all of which would have been career enders for any previous president of the United States, just doesn't seem to matter. In Trump world, where does the line where we have to pay attention begin? Is it murder? Treason? What rises to the level of this triage attention that we've been discussing?
Well, it's ordering your priorities carefully by those things that have the most human consequence. So I think the sexual assault allegations against Trump that kind of disappeared from the press. I actually think that should come back because it's an example of something that actually hurts real people. Trump's theft from his contractors and workers, that is something that was real and material. So if you just start asking the right questions, which is, who's hurt here? What is the consequence? Then I think you can begin to put things in an order of priority and assign coverage accordingly.
One of the proxies for journalists who can't get the goods on a politician that they mistrust is to catch them in some sort of naked hypocrisy. You think it doesn't really, you know, move the ball forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I think those kinds of issues, in terms of that triage question, they are low on the list of priorities. There's going to be a lot of this around building the wall, I think, where we go, well, see, look, Trump isn't actually building the wall. Well, we don't want to goad Trump into building the wall. So we should try and focus on those things that we care about rather than Trump's failure to embody what he says he believes.
So as part of the triage process, one big area that you would remove from the coronaries and throw in with the sprained ankles is fact-checking. Fact-checking?
Well, I'm not opposed to fact-checking. It's more an implication that if you fact-check Trump and you prove him wrong, you've somehow got him. You've also got to be really, really careful because sometimes there's more of a core to what he says than fact-checkers let on because they're checking the literal, precise truth of the statement and ignoring some of the underlying truth. So Trump said, Obamacare is raising your premiums 60, 70, 80%. Well, then the fact-checkers come in and they say, well, actually, it's only an average of 9%. Some premiums may rise to 60%, but not 80%. Yeah, you get that he's wrong, but you also haven't really countered the underlying point that he's trying to make. And I think this was a real failure, was a belief that you, by holding him accountable on the precision of his statistics, rather than forming effective counter-narratives to the underlying points he makes that have some emotional truth and some factual truth to them, that you could be effective.
In essence, you're saying discount the fact that he's a liar. That's been established. So let's not get bogged down in checking those facts because we will just spin our wheels endlessly for 4 years. That seems like such a surrender, such an abrogation of our fundamental responsibility as journalists to truth, or at least the facts.
No, I'm not saying do that. What I'm saying is our first duty is not necessarily to point out whether Trump is telling the truth or not, because then we'll end up writing articles that are on the subject of how many dresses in Washington are actually still available.
People did.
Right. I mean, yeah, you got to the truth, but I think that makes clear that truth is one of your duties. Journalists have other duties as well to make sure that people are informed on matters of substance rather than just being informed that their president is a liar. We have to have a sense of what creates a hierarchy of significance among lies that leads us to draw attention to particular ones versus other ones. You can't just be neutral on what matters and what's important. You really are going to be flailing for 4 years, just running this way and that, trying to fact-check everything, even though it's impossible, trying to call out his 100 character flaws. Unless you have a sense of these are the principles that matter, you know, healthcare matters because it hurts people, climate change matters because it hurts people, you don't really have a way to coherently counter Trump as a media organization.
Nathan, thank you. If you'll excuse me, I've got to go resume the fetal position and whimper.
Yeah, I'll join you there.
Nathan Robinson is editor-in-chief of currentaffairs.org and author of the upcoming book, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity, which will be released on Inauguration Day.
So, Trump lies with an abandon hitherto unknown on these shores. Some are smears, some are trial balloons, deflections or diversions. Many seem to have no motive whatsoever. But some watchers of history argue that there is a purpose and that it lies not in the nature of each particular lie, but in their sheer volume. The constant stream of BS messes with reality. Ned Reznikoff, a senior editor at the progressive news site Think Progress, draws a clear distinction between, say, how the White House of George W. Bush misled the country and how Trump does now.
The way that the Bush administration lied was very disciplined, usually intended to achieve a particular result. That's not what Trump is doing with his lies. I mean, many of his lies are mutually contradictory. Instead of creating a sort of alternative set of facts, he's trying to make it impossible to establish fact. All politicians lie at some point or another, but this sort of pattern of lying, I think, in some ways is directly hostile towards democratic governance. When you're creating a structure of untruths that isn't consistent or coherent, there's really nothing for people to latch on to. Nothing actually makes sense and nothing is fixed. So there's really nothing to discuss or negotiate.
And you've drawn a connection to the political style of a Putin advisor named Vladislav Surkov. Mm-hmm. So tell me about Surkov.
Vladislav Surkov was brought to my attention by a British documentarian named Adam Curtis, who actually came out with a film recently that references Surkov called Hypernormalization, which I recommend. Here's something from an earlier film that Adam Curtis wrote about Vladislav Surkov. Surkov turned Russian politics into a bewildering, constantly changing piece of theater. He sponsored all kinds of groups, from neo-Nazi skinheads to liberal human rights groups. He even backed parties that were opposed to President Putin. But the key thing was that Surkov then let it known that this was what he was doing, which meant no one was sure what was real or fake. As one journalist put it, it is a strategy of power that keeps any opposition constantly confused.
Fiendishly clever, but some would say it's not a political strategy. It's just Trump's personality.
Yeah, I don't want to dive too deep into Donald Trump's psychology, but I do think there's a level on which this is a strategy that must have worked well for him in business, whether or not he's familiar with the work of Vladislav Surkov. He also has advisors who do have connections to the strange gray area between American right-wing nationalist movements and allies or members of Putin's inner circle. Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, who used to be chairman of Breitbart. I would be a little bit surprised if Bannon was not familiar with Surkov's work or tactics. This is a quote that Bannon gave to The Hollywood Reporter in a profile of him when he was talking about the transition. "Darkness is good. Dick Cheney, Darth Vader, Satan, that's power."
A lot of people still desperately hold on to this belief that if we could just call out Trump's lies, if people only fully understood that he was lying, they wouldn't support him. This isn't working. Is that why? Because he's created this destabilized reality in which you just assume that everybody is lying and therefore you're under no pressure to choose the truth?
Yeah, people know that Trump is not telling the literal truth, but what they see him doing is letting them in on the joke, winking and nodding at his audience and saying, "Look, I'm a politician. They're all politicians. Everyone's a crook, but I'm your crook. I'm doing this for you."
So how does this play out? Trump presents himself in kaleidoscopic ways and you get to just pick the Trump you like?
Yes, exactly. And the example of how he's managed to appeal to both white supremacists and some politically conservative Jews is an important one, convincing members of both constituencies that he's really on their side. He just needs to play to this other side. And the way he does that is by having this malleable identity that changes depending on the audience. Instead of choosing a consistent image or a consistent message, he embraces the contradiction and oscillates between them.
One of the scariest things you note in your piece is how the relentless downpour of inaccurate or useless information can make people lose trust in their own minds.
Mm-hmm. During a campaign event, Corey Lewandowski, who was Trump's campaign manager at the time, physically attacked Michelle Fields, who at the time was a Breitbart reporter. And Ben Terris witnessed Lewandowski grabbing Fields in an aggressive way and reported it. What happened afterwards was the campaign and many of the campaign supporters just came down on him incredibly hard. You know, Ben Terris is a professional reporter, and one of the things Trump has been very effective at using against reporters is our sometimes natural inclination to scrutinize our own perception just to make sure that we're not getting anything wrong. And so they use that against him. They just aggressively denied from the very beginning that this had ever happened. They just said, no, no, no. Terrace was asked over and over again by his own editors, are you sure that's what you saw? And at some point, he started to doubt his own perception. And then the video came out confirming exactly what Terrace had said had happened. And the Trump team just pivoted.
They moved on.
To something else. Yeah.
Okay, so when reality is up for grabs, and you can choose your own version to subscribe to, if democracy relies on consensus, what kind of democracy can we have?
Well, Surkov has this term called managed democracy, which is his vision for Russia. And he believes that all democracies are really managed democracies to a certain extent. And what he's done is just sort of expose the hypocrisy at the heart of modern democracy. But the idea is that rights of democratic participation that people have essentially just boil down to rights of self-expression.
We maintain the right to express a preference for one policy or another, but in a managed democracy, in Surkov's view, we don't have any impact on the formation of that policy.
Exactly. One way to think of it might be to compare managed democracy to a good old-fashioned 20th century totalitarian state. Freedom of expression is ruthlessly suppressed. Whereas in a managed democracy, you're absolutely free to do so. It just won't make any difference.
How do we address that?
Well, I think it's easier to fight if people just know what he's doing. The press needs to be more aggressive about not just fact-checking Trump's lies, but treating the lying itself as a story and explaining why it's significant. A lot of people have talked about the post-fact world that we now live in because of Trump. I think it concedes way too much to him and his team. We do not live in a post-fact world. The facts are out there. The reality is out there. It's the responsibility of journalists to depict that reality and to explain the importance of that reality, not just to do stenography between various competing unrealities.
Once our perception of reality has been splintered, can it be reassembled? How hard would it be to scramble back after this and create a democracy based on consensus and compromise again?
That remains to be seen. The just sort of structural...
Oh, come on, Ned.
I'm sorry. I mean, that's the truth. I think the sort of structural and technological and political challenges that we're dealing with now, none of them are completely unprecedented, but they're combining in a way where I don't think there's a really obvious historical guide about how to emerge from this, which in many ways is very frightening, but at the same time means that the future is yet unwritten and it's up to the media to help write it.
Have you packed your bags?
No, not yet.
Ned, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ned Reznikoff is a senior editor at Think Progress.
This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In our editorial meeting this week, even through the speakerphone connecting me with the team in New York, the staff detected in my voice a slight suicidal despondency. Why so glum, chum? They wanted to know. And I said, it's just that we're all so it's hard to drag my sorry self out of bed in the morning. This is when producer Alana Casanova-Burgess chimed in. Bob, have you read Hope in the Dark? She was referring to the Book of Encouragement and Call to Action by left-wing activist philosopher Rebecca Solnit, who expresses optimism about the future based not on naivete or denial, but on lessons of history. Solnit is impatient with despair, not only because it paralyzes political action, but because she says it is historically indefensible. Occasioned by the invasion of Iraq, the book became so popular lately with the demoralized demographic that Solnit herself has only one copy remaining to her name. Wouldn't it be swell, Bob, for you to speak to Rebecca Solnit? Rebecca, welcome to On the Media.
Good morning or afternoon over there in New York.
So the dark in your title, Hope in the Dark, isn't about the darkest hours, but about the impossibility of knowing the future, which you say dependably surprises and rewards us. Can you start off, please, by reading from the beginning of your first essay, Looking into Darkness?
With pleasure. On January 18th, 1915, 6 months into the First World War, as all Europe was convulsed by killing and dying, Virginia Woolf wrote in her journal, "The future is dark, which is, on the whole, the best thing the future can be, I think." Dark, she seems to say, as in inscrutable, not as in terrible. We often mistake the one for the other, or we transform the future's unknowability into something certain, the fulfillment of all our dread, the place beyond which there is no way forward. But again and again, far stranger things happen than the end of the world. Who 2 decades ago could have imagined a world in which the Soviet Union had vanished and the internet had arrived? Who then dreamed that the political prisoner Nelson Mandela would become president of a transformed South Africa? Who foresaw the resurgence of the indigenous world, of which the Zapatista uprising in southern Mexico is only the most visible face? Who 4 decades ago could have conceived of the changed status of all who are non-white, non-male or non-straight, the wide-open conversations about power, nature, economies, and ecologies? There are times when it seems as though not only the future but the present is dark. Few recognize what a radically transformed world we live in, one that has been transformed not only by such nightmares as global warming and global capital, but by dreams of freedom, of justice, and transformed by things that we could not have dreamed of.
I want to read you a note from a father to his 3 daughters on election night after the kids had pledged a compact to invest their next 4 years in looking inwards towards the family and relationships and the things that mattered to them the most. The note went as follows. "Yes, we must look inwards and cherish one another, holding on to our precious love where our own values seem so under attack. But please, we must not retreat from the world. We must never stop believing in and fighting for what is just and sane. Loath as I am to be a backseat driver in your lives, I do implore you, be courageous. Live your life fighting the fight." I'm intimately familiar with those sentiments because I wrote them. But notwithstanding my encouragement to my daughters, no matter what the scope of history one day will provide, in the foreseeable future, we are likely, as a society, to go abruptly and maybe irretrievably backwards on civil rights, human rights, climate, sanity. Isn't a man permitted to be morose and desperate without surrendering? Isn't that a reasonable reaction to horrible events?
You're talking about 2 different things. How do we feel and what do we do? And I'm not telling people how to feel. I'm telling people that there is scope for action. One of the great conundrums is that unless we believe there are possibilities, we don't act, but the possibilities only exist if we seize them. And so a lot of what I've been trying to do is encourage people to recognize there is an extraordinary history of popular power in the U.S., but also around the world. I'm not an optimist, as you said in your introduction. Optimism believes that everything will be fine no matter what we do, and therefore we don't have to do a damn thing. Pessimism is the mirror image of that, that believes that everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and it gets us off the hook. We don't have to do anything. Hope for me is deeply tied to the fact that we don't know what will happen. This gives us grounds to act. And the Trump administration is such an amplifier of uncertainty. Will the guy have some kind of breakdown? Will he get impeached? Will he start World War IV? Will the Republican Party split? Will the Democratic Party find its backbone? So I think that there's grounds to stay engaged while being clear that terrible things are happening and we should mourn them.
I mentioned in the introduction your impatience with what you see as a kind of self-indulgence of despair. And I couldn't help but notice that because I took it as a personal affront. In the context of the Gulf War, you called that kind of self-indulgence the conversation. Could you read that passage?
Sometime before the election was over, I vowed to keep away from what I thought of as the conversation, the tailspin of mutual wailing about how bad everything was, a recitation of the evidence against us. One exciting opportunity the left offers us is of being your own prosecutor. That just buried any hope and imagination down in a dank little foxhole of curled-up despair. Now I watch people having it, wondering what it is we get from it. The certainty of despair, is even that kind of certainty so worth pursuing? Stories trap us, stories free us. We live and die by stories. But hearing people have the conversation is hearing them tell themselves a story they believe is being told to them. What other stories can be told? How do people recognize that they have the power to be storytellers, not just listeners?
Is there a place in this calculus, though, for the issue of running out of time, particularly with the environment? If there's a place for despair, might that be it?
And you keep wanting to talk about despair, and I'm just not very interested in it. The situation on climate, which I spent a lot of time looking at and trying to do something about as an activist, is really bleak, but there's wiggle room in there. You know, a lot of extraordinary stuff is happening, and it's happening in very complex ways. One thing that not very many people have noticed, because it's a change so incremental, is that the technology of renewable, non-carbon energy has evolved so dramatically over the last dozen years that we're in a completely different place than we were at the beginning of the millennium. Bloomberg News ran a story yesterday that within the decade, solar power is likely to be cheaper than coal, which is the cheapest fossil fuel. We actually have the energy solutions, and they are being adapted pretty rapidly in a lot of places. You know, we also are looking at the Antarctic ice shelf cracking. We're looking at sea level rise. We're looking at chaotic weather. We're in a very deep crisis. You know, and I want people to be able to hold both of those things. We're not talking about a future that's already written.
The occasion for this encounter session is that my particular hand-wringing and you talking me down acts as a proxy for others in the audience who are feeling approximately the same way I am. But I just want to move away from that for just one moment and ask you about the role of the media.
What we get from the mainstream media over and over and over is a story that what we do doesn't matter. We have had huge impacts. We have changed what constitutes what's acceptable and ordinary in innumerable ways. You can tell the story of same-sex marriage as, oh, the Supreme Court in its beneficence handed this nice thing down to us. But the Supreme Court decided that this was normal because millions of people had transformed our society in powerful ways over decades about what was normal, and so they did what seemed reasonable, but we defined what reasonable is. And that's the kind of thing I want people to hang on to, because we're going to have to define what's ethical, what's acceptable, what's realistic, what's true, particularly as we enter this regime made almost entirely out of lies. There's going to be a fight over who defines reality and what's true and who we believe.
All right, stipulated. The future is inscrutable, but humor me, please. Tell me everything's going to be all right.
It's not going to be all right. It's going to be really interesting, and some beautiful and remarkable things are going to happen, and a lot of destruction that's underway is not entirely irreversible as regards the climate. But again, there's wiggle room. You know, the day after New Orleans flooded, hundreds or maybe thousands of boat owners from inside the city and as far away as Texas went into the city with their boats to rescue people from rooftops and attics. Thousands of people were saved. And in the months and years after Hurricane Katrina, the biggest volunteer effort took place in American history, and it really changed. You know, that city could be dead, and it's not dead. I mean, some very good things came out of that. The future is not yet written. What the story is depends on what we make it, and that's really what I'm here to say.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Doing my best.
Rebecca Solnit is a writer, historian, and activist. She's the author of Hope in the Dark, Untold Histories, Wild Possibilities. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, Leia Fetter, and Ellie Lightfoot. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Terrence Bernardo.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.